Now, as you know, there are a number of ways you can tell us what you think of our program. You can send us an email or a letter, or you can post a comment on our website. Well, this may not come as much of a surprise, but people who leave comments on the internet can be really, really, really mean. Blogs and news websites, including ours, have seen more than their fair share of nasty responses and name-calling. NPR's Laura Seidel reports that some sites are reconsidering just how open they really want to be.
If you want to know what it's like to get attacked online, just ask Mikey Shu Levy. She wrote a thankful letter to the editor of the local paper when the health care bill passed. She has lupus. Her 24-year-old son can't get health care because of a pre-existing heart condition, and her husband was diagnosed with liver cancer.
So my thank you note was really about the relief I had mentally.
When Levy looked at the site the morning it was posted, she got comments like this one.
Oh, my poor baby is sick. Only the great Obama can save him. Makes me sick just reading it.
Levy was shocked by the vitriol.
And I'm going, oh my gosh, I can't believe what they're saying. Oh my goodness, this is so personal. I mean, I guess I wrote a personal story, so maybe that's what I asked for.
The Napa Valley Register, which published Levy's letter, wouldn't comment about her experience. But some sites like having personal attacks, says Scott Rosenberg, author of Say Anything, How Blogging Began.
What they really wanted was to boost traffic on their websites because the more pages that are viewed, the more ads can be sold.
Rosenberg says it was just part of the early zeitgeist of the web to let commenters say whatever they wanted.
So many media companies simply opened the doors to their websites and said, anybody come post whatever you want, and expected that they would have brilliant conversations and exchanges of ideas.
There might be a few of those, but too often it's the nasty comments that jump out. Stanford Communications Professor Clifford Nass says it's predictable when you have a lot of people vying for attention.
So ironically and tragically, if you want people to respond to what you say, say something outrageously negative.
And there's been some high-profile negativity on big sites like CNN.com. Lila King, a senior producer there, says during the last presidential election, a commenter kept putting up the same image.
It's a little cartoon of a white stick figure and a black stick figure, and the white stick figure with a machine gun in its hand shooting the other stick figure and its heart exploding and red splatters all over the page.
It isn't just the big sites. It's the little blogs and specialty sites like Religion Dispatches. The site has long-form articles that look at the places where religion and politics meet. Many of the writers are scholars and academics. Editor Lisa Webster says an article written by an expert on Islam got some terrible comments.
Someone from our funder noticed and said, by the way, we're not interested in funding, you know, providing a platform for hate speech.
Webster began to worry that the open comments were detracting from the thoughtful tone of Religion Dispatches.
It's also like old magazine days. You don't, if you're doing a restaurant review, you don't put the restaurant review next to an ad for a garbage dump or something like that. You have to think about these things.
Religion Dispatches has a radical solution. They're getting rid of comments. Readers have to send a letter to the editor. It can be an email, but only a few of the best letters get published.
I think we're going to lose traffic. I'm hoping it'll be sort of a dip. The roller coaster will dip, and then it'll tick back up eventually.
But some sites want to clean up the comments and still maintain a fast-paced response to events. Tom Mallory, the content director for the San Diego Union-Tribune's website, says recently they posted a headline that got his users mad. It was about a man who was murdered by a couple of guys who were spray-painting a wall.
The headline, unfortunately, referred to graffiti artists, which made it seem that they were, you know, Van Gogh with a spray can.
Many users accused the Union-Tribune of having a political agenda.
I waded in, said, it's a good point, I'll fix the headline. Someone asked another question about why it was written, and the readers started kind of answering it and discussing among themselves, accepting my explanation. It was a valuable reader exchange. I'm glad it happened.
Mallory says this helped him see the value of having someone on the staff take part in the conversation. But he says they don't always have the staff available. The Union Tribune is one of many sites that are using technology.
With software, you can ban certain words and phrases, and in fit of piques, as I've done, gone through the site and found every combination of characters that make nasty words and ban those characters, ban those phrases.
Mallory also thinks that anonymity is a problem. The software lets the paper track users, keep a record of their comments, and ban them. According to the makers of the software called Discuss, their 2-year-old product is now being used by 350,000 websites. But Lila King of CNN.com says her commenters have never been anonymous, yet they still had a problem. At CNN.com, they decided the solution is to have a real live person curate the comments and take part in the discussions.
Really, it's the human touch. It's actually staying inside the conversation and being active and highlighting comments that we think editorially are really interesting or significant. Set the tone for what you hope the conversation will be.
If the conversation had been more civil when Mikey Shu Levy sent her a letter about healthcare, she says she wouldn't mind if people had a different point of view.
I think it would be wonderful if we could challenge people who really disagree to have a really great conversation about it. Say a very lively Democrat and a very lively Republican, but really truly be real in what you're discussing.
If all these changes, both technical and personal, raise the level of discussion, many sites are hoping more people will feel comfortable joining in the conversation instead of just watching it explode. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
It's no secret that Apple's stock has skyrocketed. Yesterday, for the first time, all of Apple's shares were worth more than all of Microsoft's. That got us thinking about investing in Apple, something that Kyle Conroy has also been thinking about. He's a computer science major at UC Berkeley, and he has compiled a table that answers this question.
How much money would you have today if you'd purchased Apple stock instead of an Apple product? And Kyle Conroy joins us now by Skype. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So let's just tick through some of these. Let's take a PowerBook G4 with a 17-inch screen. That's a pretty coveted item when it came out back in January of 2003. And the price then was $3,299. And if you had instead invested that in Apple stock, how much would it be worth right now?
You would have $120,000. Pretty impressive.
And let's take, let's say, another product, something perhaps a little bit smaller in value, the iPod Mini. The asking price back in February of 2004 was $249. And if you hadn't purchased that iPod Mini, if you had instead purchased Apple stock, how much would you have in the bank right now?
You would have $6,103.
Again, another fine return on that investment. Now, do you have any of these products?
I bought both the original iPod and I currently own a 15-inch MacBook Pro from about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So if you were smart and you'd purchased Apple stock, you'd have a lot of money. But what about the opportunity cost?
Definitely. I'm a computer science major. My laptop is very, very important to me. So this computer has gotten through me a lot of stuff.
Kyle Conroy is a junior at UC Berkeley, and you can find a link to his blog post, Should I Have Bought That Apple Product, at our website, npr.org. Kyle, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
If you're kicking yourself right now over not having bought that Apple stock back in 2003, well, you're not alone. To try to sort some things out, we've asked Robert Benincasa of NPR's investigative unit to look at a few other products. And Robert's here in the studio. Hello.
Hello, Michelle.
Now, you specialize in digging through all kinds of data, and you've pulled together some numbers for us. Can we start with Apple's rival, Microsoft?
Sure. Let's go back to Windows 98. When it came out, it was about $89. And if you had taken that $89 and instead bought Microsoft stock, you'd have today about $85.
You would have lost money.
You've lost about $4, not counting all of the other losses from inflation and such like that. And, Michelle, these are back-of-the-envelope kinds of calculations. They don't take into consideration commissions to buy and sell stock, the taxes that you pay, dividends, and things like that. We're just kind of looking at the value of the stock.
Let's look at a John Deere lawnmower, big ticket item, a lot of money there. What'd you find?
Right. Well, let's go back a decade. In 2000, if I had spent $500 on a John Deere lawnmower, and I like this example because I don't like mowing the lawn, and instead I took that money and I bought John Deere stock, I'd have about $1,400 in stock right now, 10 years later.
And you'd probably have to use some of that money to pay somebody else to mow your lawn because
yeah, no,
your grass wouldn't be looking really good. How about cars? Let's say you bought a Ford Taurus.
Well, you know, cars depreciate over time, but we put up with that because we enjoy them. So if you bought a Ford Taurus in 2000 for $18,000, right now the car would be worth about $2,000. The stock, $18,000 back then, right now would be worth about $7,000.
Okay, so that's one example. What if you purchased a Buick?
Well, as we know, GM was delisted from the stock exchange, and the news there is kind of grim. The stock for General Motors is worth almost nothing right now, so you'd be better off with the car.
Okay, so if you're driving a Buick right now, you have a smile on your face
exactly.
As you're listening to this conversation.
Enjoy the car.
Robert Benincasa, always good to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Robert Benincasa is with NPR's Investigative Unit.
Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Jane Smiley never shies away from new terrain in her work. Among other topics, she's written about racehorses and dentistry, Dickens and dairy farms. Her latest novel, called Private Life, scrutinizes marital disappointments against the backdrop of historical tragedies. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
The heroine of Jane Smiley's latest novel, Private Life, lives with her husband at the Naval Shipyard on Mare Island, north of San Francisco. There, while in bed one evening in 1906, she feels the earth move, and it has nothing to do with her husband. A lamp falls off the bedside table, just minor damage. But over on the mainland, all hell breaks loose as San Francisco collapses in the great earthquake and fire that follows. Margaret Mayfield Early is a quiet woman who keeps her own counsel, a watcher rather than an actor in history's great dramas. The years roll on and other events transpire. Sailors leave Mare Island for service in World Wars I and II. The Spanish flu epidemic and the Great Depression hit. Margaret lives at a remove through them all, until one day she quietly realizes that the man she spent most of her life married to is, at best, a fool. This time, the epicenter of the earthquake is in her brain. Private Life is a powerful turn-of-the-last-century American novel in both chronology and style. It spans the decades from Margaret's childhood in Missouri after the Civil War up to the early years of World War II. Smiley has tried her hand at historical novels before, as well as an academic farce and even a suspense tale. But at bottom, she's always been a master chronicler of the climate changes in relationships. I think especially of her great-great novella, The Age of Grief. Here, her compelling story about a long marriage has an Edith Wharton, Henry James feel of sinister delicacy about it. Margaret is afflicted by the same strain of paralysis that defines Newland Archer in Wharton's Age of Innocence. In the opening section of the novel, shrewd older women around Margaret conspire to orchestrate her marriage at the desperately ripe old age of 27 to Captain Andrew Jackson Jefferson Early, a Navy astronomer in his 30s and the most famous man that their little Midwestern town has ever produced. Describing their courtship, Smiley's deadpan, omniscient narrator says that Margaret felt pleasing dread at Captain Early's approach and that their wedding was quickly accomplished. By the time Margaret understands both the betrayal she's been subjected to and the true character of her husband, her feeble spirit of defiance has all but calcified. Margaret and Andrew move to Mare Island immediately after the wedding because he's put in charge of the observatory there. Andrew has made a tentative reputation for himself with his theories about double stars. Soon he's filling up their small house with dusty piles of scientific journals, churning out boulder-sized books with titles like The Universe Explained, and engaging in one-sided debates with his nemesis, Albert Einstein. Reflecting on one of his manuscripts, which of course she's been expected to type, Margaret thinks, what Andrew's theory was, precisely, she could not herself have said, though she partially understood the second half of the second volume, which was that if they could harness the power of the ether, they would be as gods. Having been left to think and think and think, Andrew had made up his mind that thinking was everything. Over the decades, Margaret, like a lot of women, carves out a small, separate life for herself without explicitly recognizing this as a marital survival strategy. She befriends a Russian emigre and a Nellie Bly-type female journalist and a Japanese-American family. Our narrator tells us that Margaret, at 60, had gotten into the habit of congratulating herself for being balanced. But, she saw, she was balanced on a very narrow perch. Private Life is a wistful and beautifully observed novel about nice girls finishing last. Margaret always listened to her practical mother, who opined that romance was always the first act of a tragedy. But as Smiley makes clear, relationships that don't have their roots in passion are capable of their own peculiar devastations of spirit.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Private Life by Jane Smiley. You can read a chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
The new healthcare law will extend coverage in part by expanding eligibility for the Medicaid program for the poor. And that doesn't sit well with many governors. In fact, these Medicaid requirements are a key element of a lawsuit filed by more than 20 states challenging the law's constitutionality. But as NPR's Julie Rovner reports, a new study finds that states may be vastly overestimating how much the Medicaid expansion will cost them.
The responsibility for funding Medicaid has long been shared between the federal and state government. Rich states have traditionally split the cost 50-50. Poor states have paid as little as about 20 cents on the dollar for every Medicaid enrollee. But in writing the health overhaul, federal lawmakers knew the states were in dire financial straits, so they decided to fund most of the Medicaid expansions, explains Robin Rudowitz of the Kaiser Family Foundation.
There's full federal financing for those who are newly eligible from 2014 to 2016, and then the federal share phases down to 90% by 2020.
Amidst complaints from governors about the Medicaid expansions potentially busting state budgets, the Kaiser Family Foundation also commissioned a study by the Urban Institute. Researcher John Hollihan is the study's lead author. He says the governor's financial worries may be overstated.
The federal government will pay a very high share of new Medicaid spending in all states. The increases in state spending are pretty small compared to the increases in coverage and relative to what states would have spent if there had been no reform.
In fact, of the estimated $465 billion it will cost to expand Medicaid between 2014 and 2019, according to the study, the federal government will pay an average of 95.4% of those costs. And Hollihan says that's probably an underestimate. With so many more people covered, states will be able to cut back on other money they now spend on things like free health care for people who don't have insurance.
I think that if we had been able to account for that we would show that the savings to states from no longer having to bear as large a burden as they do now for uncompensated care would probably be greater than their new obligations for Medicaid spending.
In some cases, states might even come out ahead financially. So why aren't states happier about the new Medicaid expansions? Alan Weil of the National Academy for State Health Policy compares the state situations to finding a pair of $200 shoes on sale for $20.
If you like the $200 pair of shoes, it's a great deal because you only have to pay $20. If you look in your wallet and you see a 10 and a couple of ones and you've got some change in the bottom of your pocket and you're not sure you can come up with the $20, it doesn't really matter what a good deal it is.
In other words, even if states don't have to come up with very much money, it still may be money they don't don't have. And Weil says it's not just money. Many states are looking at the possibility of a 50% increase in their Medicaid populations.
That raises serious concerns about provider and delivery system capacity, managed care plans, hospitals, physicians, primary care, specialists. States already struggle in this area, and they worry about whether or not they can meet the increased demand.
Then, of course, there is politics. Of the 20 states that are suing the federal government over the health care bill, 19 have Republican governors. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
As of today, the U.S. government debt is nearly $13 trillion. If you're worried about that and feeling generous, you can do something. You can write the government a check. Or starting this year, you can go online and pay by credit card. David Kestenbaum and Jacob Goldstein with our Planet Money team tried it out.
Okay, so I'm at this website, pay.gov. I'm going to type in my name. Pay by credit card. Okay, how much should I give?
Let's see. The debt is $13 trillion. Divide that by 300 million people in the United States. Your share, Jacob, should be $42,000.
Right. I'm going to give 10 bucks.
All right.
Okay. Okay. Done.
It turns out a possibly surprising number of people actually make donations to help pay down the national debt. This fiscal year, so far, over 500 people have donated more than $1.6 million.
Even in 2008, when the economy fell apart, people gave more than $2 million.
So we wanted to find out more, and we talked to Dan Tangerlini. His title is actually Chief Financial Officer of the U.S. Department of Treasury.
Apparently, it started back in 1961. In fact, a public law had to be passed. Before this time, there was actually no legal authority or framework to accept gifts of any sort to the federal government.
For privacy reasons, Tangerlini can't tell us who is donating, but we filed a Freedom of Information Act request, and we did get the amounts of individual donations over the last 5 years.
Well, so the average gift is less than $1,000. The current national debt is about $13 trillion.
Sort of awesome, right? It's like talking about a molecule in the universe or something.
Right. It's a distinctly small fraction of the overall amount.
Here's some details from the numbers we got. There are a lot of small donations. 120 people gave one penny each.
And around 700 people gave, like you, Jacob, $10 or less.
But some people gave real money. There are donations of $10,000, donations of $100,000.
And last year, there was a donation of $1.5 million.
If that was you and you're listening right now, please let us know.
We're working on a story about what would happen if everyone paid their share. So if you've given any money, send us an email, planetmoney@npr.org. I'm David Kestenbaum.
And I'm Jacob Goldstein, NPR News.
For a graphic that shows the size of donations, you can go to npr.org/money. Now, helping to pay down the national debt is one way to spend your cash, but our Planet Money team also blogged this week about a guy who found something else to do with money, $250 million of it to be exact. He's buying a hipster icon.
Pabst Blue Ribbon.
What'll you have?
Pabst Blue Ribbon.
That's right, Pabst Blue Ribbon, known in classier establishments across the nation as PBR. The cheap beer has become a favorite among hip young folks. You can see them in the bars, people with a certain fondness for skinny jeans and ironic facial hair like the beer. Oh, and me too. If the deal goes through, PBR will be owned by C. Dean Metropoulos. It's the same guy who bought the Vlasic Pickles and Bumblebee Tuna brands.
What'll you have?
Pabst Blue Ribbon.
What'll you have?
Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Pabst Blue Ribbon beer.
Smoother, smoother, smoother flavors. Taste that smoother, smoother flavor.
Pabst Blue Ribbon beer.
Finest beer, sir. Anywhere.
Pabst Blue Ribbon beer.
What'll you have?
Pabst Blue Ribbon.
It's often hard to find an institution less popular than Congress. In 2006, voters were demanding change, so they sent a new class of senators to Washington. 8 new Democrats, as well as 1 new Republican and 1 independent. Those lawmakers have since run into the reality of the Senate. Nothing happens fast, if it happens at all. Terrence Samuel is a veteran Washington journalist who's been shadowing those freshman senators. His new book is called The Upper House. In it, Samuel follows a brand new group of lawmakers elected in part, he says, out of the public frustration over the war in Iraq. They soon discovered the limits of their power.
The president had just been reelected. He won in 2004. And suddenly in 2006, you had this massive turnaround. All of these senators at some point say they don't think Iraq was the central question in that election. I disagree. I think the switch in control of the Congress was essentially about Iraq. We watched them try to address that and the difficulties of working in a body like the Senate with its arcane rules, or some people would say no rules.
What are some of the personal moments that you saw where we feel this frustration of these senators suddenly saying, this isn't exactly what I expected. This is going to be a slower process than I ever imagined.
Well, these are all very smart people. And so part of what they do is they try to pick their spots. The four people who were central to the book, John Tester of Montana, Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, Jim Webb of Virginia, and Bob Corker.
Three Democrats and then Corker,
Republican, the one
Republican from Tennessee.
So, for example, Klobuchar had this one amendment in the energy bill in 2007, and she wanted to establish a carbon registry, which would ask companies to report how much carbon they are releasing into the atmosphere. Well, she ran up against Senator James Inhofe, former chairman of the committee, a Republican from Oklahoma, who just absolutely refused to have it in the bill. There was nothing she could do. She tried to track him down.
Running around Senate office buildings and places to find him. And
she said, you know, I've tried to be nice. I've tried to be firm. And in frustration, one day she just went to the floor and expressed her absolute shock that one senator can block this from happening. But she was learning.
And you made a lot of trips to follow these senators back home. What did you hear? Were they different people on the floor compared to in those, you know, town hall meetings and parks?
Well, what's interesting about doing the freshman class is that they have not yet people in the Senate call, they've not yet gone purple, which means going from an ordinary person to going to this kind of grand eminence.
And that's this inevitable process that happens to these senators over time.
Yeah, it's the royal purple because there's always staff around you, people who hand you things when you need it. You walk down the hall and doors open. But there is some grunt work involved in the Senate. And that job essentially falls to the freshman class of the majority.
Low man or woman on the totem pole.
Right. So they spend a lot of time sitting in the chair while, you know, somebody's making a speech about rainwater in their state or cheering on the high school state basketball champs. There's a lot of that.
You followed this group of freshmen elected in 2006. The only Republican in that group was Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, who was once the mayor of Chattanooga. And he told you, you mean I campaigned 25 months and 2 days to do this? And he said about half of what we're doing in the Senate is absolutely useless.
That was Senator Corker, clearly frustrated by being not in charge the way he had been used to, also being in the minority in the Senate. It's very difficult because you do not control the agenda. What you do have in the minority is the real power in the Senate, which is the power to say no. Clearly, Republicans did that over and over again during that early part of 2007 on the war. Senator Corker, however, as we know, has gone on to something of a reputation as somebody who works across the aisle. And I think that is in some ways a reflection of the kind of class he came out of, mostly Democratic, but also very change-oriented. I mean, this was the class that had been charged with changing kind of the dynamics in Washington. And I think he's still in some ways reflective of that.
There's almost a sense in the book that when the Senate is moving very slowly, it is in theory at its most successful.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, the Senate was intended to be kind of an obstructionist institution. It was a reflection of the mistrust that the founders had in how well we will govern ourselves. But in some ways, I think the people who succeed are people who learn to live and thrive in that sense of frustration. It's in some ways where gridlock kind of feels like success.
We've been talking to veteran Washington journalist Terrence Samuel about his new book, The Upper House, an inside look at the workings of the U.S. Senate. Terry, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.